Kitchen talks about food. Dadalana Kitchen talks recipes. Dadalana Kitchen talks about lots of other things on Community Radio.
Welcome to the Dadalana Kitchen. My name is Lana Noctigal.
And I'm Donna Prisgintas.
We are here in our home kitchens, actually. This is home kitchen number 7, coming to you via the studio at KHOI. And we are going to bring you the Dadalana Kitchen. We talk about food, farming, advice, recipes, and opinions.
Oh, yes. The Dadalana Kitchen show is sponsored in part by the Mucky Duck Pub, where pub means community.
Thanks to all of you for joining us today. And thank you for supporting Community Radio. Community Radio has been a fine link to life here the past month. Actually, it's more than a month now. So let's keep talking to one another. Let's keep listening to one another. We are still here. We will get through this together. Today on the Dadalana Kitchen, we're going to look at our food supply, our meat supply, and how it's being affected by COVID-19. Bacon, anyone? Anyone? We're going through our freezers and having some good home-cooked meals. But the idea of all of this food has to come from someplace, not only being grown, being produced. It needs to be shipped. It needs to be processed. It needs to be packaged and resent. And there's quite a to-do going on.
Yeah, here. Most of us don't keep a pig in the backyard anymore.
No, we don't. And chickens and cows and goats and okay. But, however, it feels like spring today. We had a much needed little bit of a rain here this morning. Things are greening up. A friend gave me a bag of the first asparagus. Now, if that isn't spring, I don't know what it is. Oh, we're looking forward to first asparagus for supper tonight. And I've been out in the garden putting things in and looking forward to a good spring. Thank goodness for the rain.
How about the rhubarb? You think the rain will hurt the rhubarb, Lana?
Oh, no. It couldn't be better. This probably wasn't the best time to break apart and replant some rhubarb. But I did anyway because I had some growing where I didn't want it. So I have refussed and put rhubarb in a new place. Well, a little bit of rhubarb in a new place and mulched it well with newspapers, then I put some compost around it. Then I just happened to have a pile of well-composted, it's been sitting there for way too long, folks, some wood chips. And I've been doing the right thing. I tucked in those little rhubarb starts, and along with all the other stuff, they are doing good. They're doing good. So it's also, we think about food coming up, and everybody gets hungry for their famous first favorite things of the spring. It is time for farmers markets, and it's a whole new ball game out there for farmers markets.
Yes, now farmers markets have been designated as essential parts of the food system to remain in operation, thank goodness. But how they're going to do that safely, tell us, Lana.
Oh my, people thought that, or farmers that we thought, well, farmers markets are just all fun and games. People go out and have a good time on a Saturday morning or on the main street.
We do buy food there.
We do buy food there. And for many cases, that is a big chunk of farm income, huh? Farmers plant things early and get ready to bring us food. Think of a farmers market as an outdoor grocery store. Yes, it is. It is a very necessary sort of thing. Also, on a nice day, it's open air, and there is space for social distancing there. And things are happening that are going to include that farmers markets can happen and be safe. I got some information here from the market master, Lojean Peterson. She worked things out with the city of Ames and figured out how to do something safe. They're still planning on opening the first farmers market Saturday, May 6th.
That's the Main Street
Farmers Market. That's the Main Street Farmers Market. And they're working on opening that, and being...
Wait, say that date safe. Again.
May 9th. May 9th, yeah. There it is, May 9th.
Hopefully that's a Saturday.
I think it is. Anyway, not this Saturday, the next Saturday. And here are some reasons that they think it's going to work. People are going to have to take responsibility for being safe. None of this jostling to be the front, at the front there, and get in line. That take turns, and you've got to not be fondling all the food, okay? Be careful. Here's some points that they've considered. First thing, vendors will be spaced out, leaving a space between vendors. Now, I've vended at Farmer's Market. I never considered ourselves spaced out. I thought we were really quite with it and alert and brave to be. But anyway, now, see, it's a whole new world. Vendors will be spaced out.
Okay? I wonder if that means they're all going to get drunk before they come to the Farmer's Market.
Well, we could
all
use a little. I don't know. Okay, vendors will be asked to wear gloves and change every hour. Huh? No reusable bags will be allowed. Only new clean plastic bags, huh? No food sampling. Oh, people will miss that. Okay. Mm-hmm. Require all vending surfaces to be frequently cleaned. So let's be clean here. Disinfectants. Remember, disinfectants. Streets will be marked for social distancing in front of vendors. A good idea. Sorry, no music and no special events for children. Oh, there used to be petting zoos and face paintings and cookie contests. Well, we'll have to just kind of make do with
that. Not right now.
No. Usually there's tables and chairs set up for visiting and eating. No, none of that. 3 hand washing stations will be set up. Vendors who are ill do not come to market, and they won't be charged booth fees for that day. And that's strongly awful. Encourage all customers who are not feeling well, please stay home. And here is a really good idea. They're going to be, and I think they're still working on it, but they are coming up between the Ames Main Street Farmers Market and the Ames Chamber of Commerce are developing an online ordering system for the Ames Main Street Farmers Market. And through that virtual marketplace, customers can order online, and staff and volunteers will load your produce into the trunks of cars as they drive through a pickup point.
Oh, good. So you don't have to hand them paper money or anything.
If you'd rather do that, I think that's a good service. But if you'd rather go and look at a distance from your farmer, you can certainly do that. And I think a nice hello and a nice thank you for doing this would be appropriate. And I'm sure there will be well-thought-out ways to pass money and cards back and forth and keep those bottles of hand sanitizer at the ready.
Well, and this is what all the farmers have to do. I think also it's important as us shoppers, you know, we have some responsibility to wear your mask. Make sure you're not crowding your neighbors, and it's the shoppers who control the social distancing to some degree. So, and this is true in our grocery stores as well. So everybody, you know, we do have individual responsibility here. Okay,
we can do that. My trips to grocery stores have been few and far between, and people with masks and having gloves and hand sanitizers there, and I appreciate the sign that says, please don't handle produce, because I'm one of those that kind of riffles through the beets there and try to get to the good ones. We can be a little more...
You can let that careful. Go right now.
Yeah, we can let that go.
Now, I did see, although I sewed masks this week for everybody in my house, but, you know, I realize not everyone these days has sewing skills or sewing machines, but I did see an interesting thing. Besides the fold the kerchief with rubber bands, there's that one. I saw a new one online where you use a T-shirt. Everybody has a T-shirt. There's some fantastic way of pulling it on over your head and wrapping it around your nose and then tying it behind your, you know, Google it, guys. Everybody can wear a T-shirt mask.
We are making a difference. This is good. We are making a difference. And let's just kind of stay safe And even if it's spring, let's enjoy farmers market. Let's enjoy all this new food coming up. That's good. We're going to continue our discussion about the food supply. Donna, you've got a lot of news.
This qualifies as bummer news, basically. But this is specifically about Iowa. So we, as of today, when the first thing I saw when I turned on my internet was from the website called the Ag Insider, headline, Iowa leaders ask federal indemnities for hog culling. All right, this is us. This is here right now.
Wait. Culling, not calling.
Culling.
Oh, culling.
No, we're not calling the hogs. We are culling them, which is a nice word for, we're not killing them to eat. Okay, so Grassley and Ernst and our governor and our Secretary of Ag, Mike Naig, all went to Pence with this proposal, and here's, I'm going to read this to you. Because these numbers are staggering. Farmers across the nation may be forced to kill 700,000 hogs a week because of coronavirus closures and slowdowns at slaughter plants. Okay, that's not killing them to eat them. That's killing them because we cannot process them. This is waste. This is sad. This is terrible. Because not only do they kill them, then they have to bury them. I mean, the farmer loses the profit. I mean, it's a disaster. It is definitely not good. And, of course, you know, our elected leaders, as they should be doing, are asking for help from the federal government. So within Iowa, or nationally, that's 36% of U.S. hog slaughter capacity was idled on Monday. Comes from successful farming. Simply put, Iowa pork producers cannot, this is from the letter that they wrote to Pence, simply put, Iowa pork producers cannot operate if they can't send their pigs to market. We strongly urge that farmers are indemnified, that means paid out, basically, whole financially, for their euthanized hogs, including costs associated with depopulation and environmentally sound disposal, to help preserve Iowa's pork industry. Iowa, by the way, is the number one hog state with 24.6 million head, or 32% of the U.S. inventory at the last count. Okay, so it's reached some dire proportions here.
We think about, bacon's a good thing, or if you eat meat, there it is. There, it goes through a big process there. It's not just the farmer. We count on people to slaughter our hogs and cut them up and package them and get them into grocery stores. And it seems we have a bottleneck because the processing people, the butchers that are in the big processing plants are getting ill. They work close to each other, and coronavirus in a couple of those plants in Iowa has closed down those plants.
This is from an article on April 20th. Governor Kim Reynolds announced the state will focus on COVID-19 testing on meatpacking plants, swabbing all employees. Strike teams of epidemiologists and infectious disease nurses will also trace those who contacted infected workers and other Iowans. Later, Reynolds added that 250 National Guard members had been activated and that their mission includes helping to keep meat processing plants open. Despite the potential for meatpacking plants to mutate into hotbeds of infection because of the close quarters in which employees work, Reynolds said she declined to close the facilities. This was the Waterloo facility. This was on April 20th. She said, we must do our part to keep them open and safe in a responsible way. However, later, that plant was forced to close. It's just not
too much.
This is not happening. But she was somewhat proactive compared to, says, processing facilities in other states aren't even getting that much support. While Iowa has 23 major meat processing plants, Four states have more: Arkansas, Georgia, Texas, and North Carolina. And none of them even got the response that Reynolds gave. So, okay, a little bit of kudos for Reynolds. It's all, you know, it's a, although unfortunately it is a bit too little, too late.
Let's think about this a minute here. We have to, because the numbers were staggering, even when things were going well, the number of hogs that are grown and processed here in this state, way more pigs than people. I mean, it's not a joke. It's the truth, folks. And now we kind of came to a roadblock. And now they're talking about culling, euthanizing, killing,
wasting, burying. Yeah.
And just kind of think ahead here. Seems a lot of people are out of work. Food banks are really scraping by. Something in the supply chain is not working here. And I hope we come up with a better idea of than just killing the pigs and putting them in a hole.
Right, fixing the immediate problem. I do want to note that during, you know, this obvious moment when we are having to kill and dispose of unwanted pigs, for a number of years, legislation to limit the amount of confinement operations, pork confinement operations in Iowa, has been stalled in the legislature. Hopefully, people might now conclude that maybe we have enough CAFOs, maybe we don't even need any more, because now the government, the federal government, using our tax dollars, is going to have to bail these guys out. It's a mess. So part of the reason we, you know, what's kind of happened, it's not just meat processing that's having these problems. So as soon as restaurants and institutions close down, we think of food at the grocery store, because that's where most of us, we either get our food from restaurants or the grocery store sort of thing. So there are actually two separate supply chain mechanisms in the food industry. One is for what's called institutional packaging, which means 50-pound boxes of chicken thighs, for example. Or then there's the grocery or retail packaging, which means six thighs in a little plastic tray covered in cellophane, right? So when the schools were closed, the restaurants were closed, the majority of packaging and processing was no longer useful. So all of that, the processing plants had to change as quickly as they can. I had an example, let's see, about an onion guy. So there was an onion packer somewhere in the Pacific Northwest, and unlike some farmers, at least he did his own packing on farm. So he immediately had to stop packing the 50-pound bags of onions or the 25-pound bags and go to the 3- and 5-pound bags. So he was able to save a lot of his produce, but you can't pack as quickly that way. And for him to get more of the smaller bag pieces of equipment that do the 3- to 5-pound bags, it's 6 months and ordering it from a European company. So you can't just like immediately, you know, so you have to turn off the size of packaging for the larger institutions and switch. I mean, the same thing has happened with flour. It's like, okay, we were buying lots more flour at the grocery stores. Now, those are usually 1-pound packs, 5-pound packs, 3-pound packs, you know, the kind that you take home and use yourself. Okay, we were running out of flour at the grocery stores. There's plenty of flour. That's not the problem. The problem is the problem, and the packaging is the problem. So it brings me back to this. There's a saying that we've often heard in Iowa, you know, you've got to grow more food. Iowa is feeding the world, right? The exhortation that we need to feed the world. The implication is that there are large parts of the world where people are going hungry, which is true. However, the research on that is the reason people are going hungry in the parts of the world where they are going hungry is because of distribution. It is not that we do not produce enough food. It is the way the food is then gone from the farmer to the processor to ship to. So it's distribution, distribution, distribution. Okay, now let me just say this. The chickens have come home to roost here.
Oh.
Okay, distribution is not that, you know, the poor starving people in Ethiopia are not getting our corn. Distribution is now an American issue because our distribution system, which is large, very, very large and unwieldy, it's not serving us in the present moment. Let me just say that I called like our local processing plant and they're doing very well, thank you. It's small, it's a Story City locker. On that scale where you know your farmer, he brings you the pig in and you tell him what you want, that's working very well. And the farmers that have converted to local markets are not having to kill their pigs or their cows or dump their milk or things like that. However, in this country, we have lost most of that. I mean, I'm going to make a conservative guess that local food systems in America are less than 1% of our market share.
I've read that. Yeah. Too. And people, good idea. People think that is a good idea, and people are catching on. But maybe we'll catch on a little faster because all of a sudden, maybe people are getting the idea that maybe we should buy our meat directly from the farmer, which is a great idea.
Well, it's still not. It's not like you go and you pick up the pig. You still have to have local processors,
unless you know how to do it yourself. But I'm afraid, well, not too many of us do.
Well, we could. Lonnie and I could. We can kill our own chickens. We could both. We've done that. We can manage that. We've all participated in medium-sized livestock, like a hog butcher. It's not, you know, it's not USDA certified, but it can still be done.
For home use.
Yeah. But most people don't know how to do it, don't have the space to do it, understand the sanitation requirements.
It's the stuff that our parents and grandparents knew. I mean, my family grew up, and I grew up in a family that deer hunted, and none of that meat ever went to waste. We learned how to butcher it well and put it away. But it's not something you can just kind of learn off of a Google search right
away. No, it requires a certain amount of equipment, like freezers, for example. Do you know that it's almost impossible to buy a freezer right now?
I heard that. I was talking to Meg Filbert, who works for Practical Farmers of Iowa, and people are calling. She talks about grazing and selling directly meat, and farmer had a great idea. He said, "Well, people are a little hesitant to buy a side of beef or a pig from me." He said, "I got a great idea. I'll just buy a freezer and give it to the whole thing already and put the meat in there." He cannot buy freezers.
For love or money.
No. And guess what? A lot of the freezers are not made in the United States anymore. So the idea of necessary things and important frontline things we have to have, it's very, very complicated. Oh, goodness. Yes, it is. I want to take a little time here and remind you that you are listening to KHOI Community Radio, and this is the Donalana Kitchen. This is Tasty Radio for the heart of Iowa. We are back. That was a little music from Bob Black, who is providing some social distancing because he's clear over on the eastern side of the state of Iowa. But we have his banjo, and we're glad to hear Bob Black and his banjo anytime. This is the Donna Lana Kitchen. We are talking about our food supply. Along with everything else, it seems like it's a whole new ball game out there. We're talking about the fact that big processing plants are closed and meat supplies are kind of screwy right now. And people are lining up at food banks, are being hungry. I talked to my friend Megan Filbert from Practical Farmers of Iowa, and she's kind of on the cutting edge. She hears things. She's always connecting up with local food producers. CSAs, Community Supported Agriculture, is just absolutely booming because all of a sudden, people are connecting up with farmers. She said a small CSA farm in down by Des Moines, south of here. It's called Sundog Farm. They've been doing things for years, and they generally had about 150 shares they'd sell each year, and all of a sudden,
people... Wait, these are meat shares?
No.
This is vegetables.
But even that food too. And all of a sudden, people are lining up. They have a waiting list of 40 people, and that's fine and good. But you can't just like hurry up a garden. You can't like sign on everybody. And she said people are getting a little testy, that the fact that they're often pay more, or how can I come to the head of the line, or people are getting testy about their vegetables. It may be an interesting summer, which might be interesting to watch at farmers markets too. Oh my goodness. And there was a little report from the Madison Farmers Market, Madison, Wisconsin, who has a great history of good farmers markets there. They installed a call-ahead drive-by. Farmers will have packages ready for you kind of thing.
That's the farmers market that's on the Capitol Square,
yeah,
right?
I'm not
all
sure.
The way,
yeah,
around the mm-hmm. square. So you just drive around the square and pick up your...
I'm not sure how the logistics of it are, but...
Could be a good traffic jam there.
But, funny you should ask. Their first trial, people decided, well, I've got money. I didn't call ahead, but I'll just try to butt in line here. Or you know, one person doing the wrong thing kind of screws it up.
Gums up the worst.
Everybody. So let's be a little cognizant about the fact we are dealing with interesting times.
I was reading an article where the questions that people have, I'm going to try and answer some of them. This is from a magazine called The Counter. It is a meat industry magazine or something. The question was, will I be able to buy meat at the grocery store? In the short term, yes. Representatives from the pork, beef, and chicken industry spoke to said there's no shortage of meat destined for grocery stores. It might take stores a little longer than usual to restock certain items due to panic related disruptions or maybe trucker shortage. But there's a lot of meat frozen around the country. Now, this will hold out for a month or so. Now, if we're down the road and we still don't get a better handle on how to protect the workers from coronavirus, it could get a little dicey. But, you know, we're still good for another probably 6 weeks. And the other question is, will meat get more expensive? Most likely, yes. Though it's hard to estimate just how much. The cost of labor per pound of meat produced is going to go up because of the labor challenge. And, of course, that is going to be passed on to the consumers. So, it's going to get a little more expensive.
From what I've heard, again, I keep my eyes open and ears open for this, too. However, the prices of meat, the money is not trickling down, as they say, to the farmers.
No, it's not.
Bottom, like you think the bottom fell out of the oil market, and you're wondering why gas prices are going down. For some reason, somehow, all of this profit has not trickled down to the farmers.
Yes, I heard from Southwest Iowa, that they were trying to sell pigs for $35 each. Of course, you still have to get them processed.
You have to have
a freezer, right?
Yeah, that's a whole pig. $35 for a whole pig.
And then you tack on $100 for the processing. Mm-hmm. But that's, you know, it says the same answer on the price of meat was for processors. For processors, however, a different scenario is playing out. Meat has become quickly cheaper. Poultry, pork, and beef producers have all reported that gluts in animals ready for slaughter have dropped. There's too many of them, and that's because of what we talked about. The restaurant and industrial supply chain, institutional supply chain is breaking down. But the problem with the farmers is they have a backlog of the animals that are ready for market, but with nowhere to go. So that means the meat packers are not paying as much. Of course, who's getting all this profit? It's cost to consumers. The farmers are making less. It doesn't look good. It said, with limited harvest capacity, a surplus of pigs exists, causing hog values to plunge. This is from the National Pork Producers Council. Same thing is going on with beef. The thing is, there is an animal ready for slaughter must be marketed within a 2 to 3 week window. It's even smaller for chickens. The smaller the animal, the less of a marketing time frame they have. Otherwise, the animal becomes overweight and it begins to degrade in quantity, which is why yesterday they started killing off 700,000 pigs per week.
Good.
It's just a nightmare. Oh.
Another problem I heard about, and I think does this have to do with pig feed? Does this have to do with cows? Spent grains.
Pigs. Well, pigs, no, okay. Maybe cows too.
Grain production that goes to ethanol.
And the beer brewers too.
The leftover stuff, the mash. It's good animal feed. But all of a sudden, if the ethanol plants aren't going...
Yeah, ethanol production is down by roughly, I believe I read 50%.
Oh, my.
That's a lot, especially here in Iowa.
And the local breweries, too. And so, okay, things are a lot more complicated than we thought.
Well, here's something we need to pay attention to. So this is from that same article from Counter. Much of the pork and profits of this system are extracted from rural communities by these highly profitable global companies. As for the $9.5 billion allocated to the USDA, it is not clear how it will be spent. Industry advocates like the National Pork Producers Council are asking the agency to purchase large amounts of pork to clear some of the backed up supply. But that money may not benefit the meat, may benefit the meat processors more than the growers who need it. In a press release this last Thursday, the Campaign for Family Farms and the Environment called for direct distribution of government aid to farmers and workers, not big companies like Smithfield. Much of the pork and the profits of the system are extracted from the rural communities. As we said, public aid needs to get to those who need it most, workers off the job and independent farmers who have lost their markets. Keep your eye on those dollars, folks. We are getting bailed out. The taxpayers who are doing this. So let's watch where they're sending that money.
Now, think about your bacon. Think about your bacon. Also, it's not just beef and pork and chickens, too. Milk. All the cows are doing their
milk. Milk
and vegetables. They're dumping milk. I remember in times in the past where milk was dumped as a protest to get
milk prices supported up.
Yeah. I don't think that ever worked because milk prices are always in
just
the bottom anyway.
Going down.
Now it is more profitable to dump milk.
Well, let's say it costs less to dump the milk than to try and store it. It's like oil. They've run out of places to store it. So there's some interesting... Although I read that instead of just pouring it down the drain, actually the milk can be used as a fertilizer.
Yeah, it is. It is. Think calcium, folks. You can put,
even the proteins, I would think when they biodegrade would, you know, break down into compost-like qualities. The other, Lana had a other good thing that she read.
It's not all bummer news. No, here is a use for the product that comes when you make cheese. Whey. Making whey into something besides something to dump. Okay? The rise of milk vodka. Huh? Vodka made out of milk. Fermented dairy drinks have had a lengthy history. Genghis Khan's army was fueled by fermented mare's milk in the 13th century. And nomadic shepherds were drinking kefir. Huh? There is a...
I drink kefir.
So there is a... Making vodka out of the whey that comes as a byproduct of making cheese. So also think of putting some of your milk into making cheese. Cheese is good.
Cheese can store longer than fresh milk, too. That's a storage issue.
Very good. The result is a drink that's creamier and sweeter than traditional vodka made with potatoes or grain. And on top of its smooth taste, whey vodka has been heralded as an environmental way to use a byproduct of cheese. So they're trying it out.
We're going to just get creative here.
So there's a dairy in Oregon and the West Coast that is making not alcohol, but cowcohol out of cow's
milk. Cowcohol.
Okay. So think of that. Benefits for the creameries, for the cheese making places too, because they have a use for what used to be just thrown away. We have to learn new things. Yes, we do. Let's see.
Oh, the Art Cullen stuff. We're big fans of Art Cullen, so he is the editor and the writer, the Pulitzer Prize winning writer of the Storm Lake Times.
And Storm Lake has a connection.
They have a big meat processing plant there, so it is a big issue. I pulled and thanks to Nick Odie at PFI for passing this on to me. This is an editorial from April 17th, and he's talking about, so he's in Buena Vista County. And he's complaining about the lack of information up there. He said, here we live in a vacuum. The last we knew, Buena Vista County had 2 reported cases of the virus. We do not know how many tests had been administered or when or how. We do not understand why the tests apparently occur in Sioux Falls or Columbus Junction, but not the same number in Storm Lake. Testing does occur here, but authorities dare not say much more. We do not know for certain what protective equipment is issued to essential workers in any number of industries, like healthcare or food processing and distribution. We know that Tyson is trying to get what is needed for its employees to keep the lines moving. The federal and state governments that declare that these industries essential and command them to produce offer little help, but to exempt them from providing worker protection. And then he quotes Chuck Grassley, who says, I don't think anybody's going to back legislation that would say that we're going to start giving health care to undocumented workers.
Ooh.
Or to really anyone else, says Art Cullen.
Ooh.
This is what the senator got it wrong. And then he says, everyone in Storm Lake is thinking about every worker, documented or not, because we are in this boat together. Their health is our health, we can see. This is something politicians don't understand in the comfort of their Virginia bunkers. We know that we are all better off when everyone can see the doctor without fear for the purse or detention. We know that immigrants, legal or not, fear that has been created over the past several years. Storm Lake is safer from crime, disease, and poverty when everyone comes out of the shadows. Chuck Grassley might never understand that, but the voters here do. So that's my Art Cullen article. And you had one too.
Oh.
I think Art Cullen looks like Mark Twain.
He does look, yeah.
Yeah. Okay, he's our own Iowa Mark Twain.
Also, he's a good journalist. He is thinking a little beyond the workers. Of course, the workers are important, but talking about being up close and personal with your fellow processing plant line employees where you can get the disease from, there are a lot of diseases that happen in animals, livestock. Livestock lives in confined areas, which is not good for the livestock.
Well, it's not good for people either. Living in slums and too not enough personal space for the pigs or the cows or the people.
There's an article here that I wish to talk about. It's from a magazine that I get called The Progressive Populist, and Art Cullen writes in it. He wrote an article called "We're Not Ready for More Pandemics. They're Brewing in Livestock." Think about where flus and things come from, avian flu. He talked to a veterinarian, a person at Iowa State University, Dr. James Roth, Director of Center for Food Security and Public Health in the College of Veterinary Medicine. And he's got some concerns here. This is a quote from Dr. Roth. "Our systems are in danger. All kinds of animal-based diseases get shipped all over when we're moving big quantities of animals around. There's things like Ebola from hogs, meningitis from Malaysian pigs, foot and mouth disease, classic swine fever, also called hog cholera, avian influenzas, and African swine fever." So those kind of viruses and diseases, they're going along quite well, besides the COVID stuff that we are dealing with here. "If they come to the United States, we're really not prepared. Our systems are in danger," says Dr. Roth. And why is that? Here's a little bit because. This is what Art Cullen says. "Because Congress and the federal government over the last few years has decided to defund the scientists that study and develop plans for dealing with this sort of thing. Livestock research is frozen, and when scientists asked Congress in the last farm bill for $250 million to strengthen animals' disease response systems, testing and diagnosis, they only got $30 million out of the $250 million. And they've been kind of raising the red flag for quite a while, saying, wait a minute here, this stuff is getting out of control. At least we should monitor it. Think about how that affects Iowa. Iowa livestock industry depends vitally on a safe and secure food processing protocol. This means we have to apply the research that's going on all the time, and we have to develop vaccines and all that kind of stuff. This all has to do with what we do as a federal government, because you can't just do it like just in Storm Lake or just in Ames, Iowa. It kind of deals with all of us. This is just another something to think about. Then also, I don't know if they know for sure the idea of where this COVID virus came from, but supposedly a lot of these...
Well, we don't know where it came from, but you know what? We can't put the genie back in the bottle anyway. So there's been in the last 2 days, New Zealand has actually had very tremendous success. And I know, because my daughter and my grandson live there, so I've been following it very closely. They have got down to single digits, and they did that well. First of all, they're an island in the middle of the Pacific, so they could control the coming and going. But they were very proactive. Testing, tracing, shut it down. And this is, you know, it's turning out to be, and we won't know till we're through this and see what actually works, but those methodologies are looking pretty good. I want to give you an example in the meat processing industry. Now, it's too soon for these companies to toot their horn, but I'm going to use an example, and we will follow up on this later. Purdue, which is a big, big, big chicken company, right? Okay, it's American-owned. It's actually still family-owned. The Purdue family is very involved in running the business. Purdue took very good early precautions in their processing plant. They provided in-house clinics for all of their workers and their workers' family. Anybody could come in and, you know, talk to a doctor or a nurse and, you know, get a health check so they knew where they're at. They provided protective equipment for their workers. They got in there and they were worried about their workers. Okay, now, some other larger multinational corporations like Smithfield and Tyson were not as quick on it. You know, it's like, oh, you know, we don't want to spend the money. Well, of course, in the long run, it turns out costing a lot more money if you do not take care of your workers. So when we're through this, we will try to get a report on some of those companies, large though they may be, who have been much more proactive, more worker care centric, and hopefully that this is going to turn out to be a better job. I do want to say there are other models of meat processing. For example, in Iowa, there is the Niman Ranch system, which is now owned by Purdue. The farmers that are working for Niman Ranch, they have animal welfare standards, so there are no confinement operations. All the farmers have pigs either in deeply bedded hoop houses or out, you know, running around, pasture fed. And these farmers are still getting their market price. They're not having to cull their herds. It's a smaller system, more decentralized, but it's still a large system. We can do this. It's not like everybody has to go back to growing their own pigs.
Right. Niman Ranch, it's not like you buy directly from Niman Ranch. Is in grocery stores. It's a delivered, packaged up stuff. So,
and a lot of independent family farmers do sell their meat to Niman Ranch, and Niman Ranch has been able to, because it's a higher quality product, they have really good standards for, you know, the way the meat looks and tastes, and of course they have great humane standards. So it commands a higher price in the supermarket, and their farmers are compensated. That price goes back to the farmers above market price. So there are models there for reasonable ways to do business without, you know, just bringing it down to one person buying one pig, which is great if you can do it. But, you know, we're a long ways from that. So what can a consumer do? Well, as we've said before, eat a little bit less meat, but pay for higher quality and for better, you know, there is a perceived and a real value to this. And it's not just that the farmers and the processes are more well taken care of. Mm-hmm. You know, it's hard to say this, but yeah, we need to pay more for our food.
Yes, we do.
And waste less. How about that?
Yeah, we'll do this. I want to mention this is KHOI, and this is the Donna Lana Kitchen. You can find out more about the Donna Lana Kitchen at khoifm.org. You can find out more about all the other fine programming, which just this last weekend, KHOI had a whole Saturday celebrating a local eco fair here. It was eco fair on the air. Socially distanced, and lots of good people came on and talked about the environment. It was a good job, KHOI. You did good. Also, I want to mention, too, that if you're feeling a little down, a little peckish, perhaps, you're feeling you might be having a COVID moment or a COVID incident, do not rush into the doctor. Do not rush into the emergency room. Call your doctor. Take your temperature, because that's the first thing they're going to ask. Take your temperature if you can. And if you don't have a doctor, call 211. That is the COVID hotline. Well, we're social distancing here. People are at home. People are a little testy about being home here. I ran across a poem I'd like to share in a book that was edited by Garrison Keillor, and it's called Good Poems for Hard Times. Before this COVID couple weeks here, I thought this was kind of a bummer book. My goodness, a lot of really kind of down in the mouth poems, my goodness. But there are some gems in here. Here is a little poem by someone named Ginger Andrews, and she's a poet out in the state of Oregon, and she teaches Sunday school and she cleans houses for a living. And this is a little poem about being home, being kind of stuck at home. It's called The Cure. The Cure by Ginger Andrews. Lying around all day with some strange, new, deep blue weekend funk, I'm not really asleep when my sister calls to say she just hung up from talking with Aunt Bertha, who is 89 and ill, but managing to take care of Uncle Frank, who's completely bedridden. Aunt Bert says It's snowing here in Arkansas on Catfish Lane. She hasn't been able to walk to the mailbox. She's been suffering from a bad case of the mully grubs. The cure for the mully grubs, she tells my sister, is to get up, bake cake, and if that doesn't do it, put on a red dress.
There you have it. Bake a cake and put on a red dress.
It's got to help. And it's funny, this poem was written like in 2003 or something. It really wasn't about the
current state of affairs.
But there it is. So if you're experiencing the mully grubs, two good bits of advice there. Bake a cake, yes. Oh, very good. I ran across the list of people are discovering recipes. Oh boy, they're just and people are baking kind of their old favorites. And because of what people can get at the grocery store, banana bread seems to be a big thing. You can make a bunch of it. You can also save it for a while or pass it around. I made a banana bread last night. I just happened to have some bananas that needed a home. Here's my recipe. I like it. Half cup butter or margarine melted, added to 1 cup sugar, 2 eggs, 3 medium-sized mashed bananas, that's about a cup, 1 cup regular flour, 1 cup whole wheat flour, 1/2 teaspoon salt, 1 teaspoon soda, 1/3 cup hot water, and 1/2 cup chopped walnuts. It's good. Put that all together. Bake it in a slow oven for a little over an hour. It's good. Banana bread will always get you through. And I always cut back on the sugar and up the whole wheat flour. Something about the whole wheat flour in this banana bread. It does good.
Whole wheat pastry flour.
Yeah. Speaking of flour that you can get now, it's one of those quick breads. It'll be good. Great. Oh, I also want to mention that life goes on. Good things happen. On a really nice sunny day last week, my neighbor, Les Schickel, celebrated his 102nd birthday.
Woohoo!
102-year-old last week, and we drove by and dropped off a card and said hi from the driveway.
He's still living at home at 102.
For all I know, he's putting out his tomato plants. I'm not sure. Okay. There you go. Well, you've been listening to the Donna Lana Kitchen. My name is Lana Noctigal.
And I'm Donna Priskintas.
We had excellent engineering by Mike Murphy. Thanks, Mike. Eat good food and enjoy life.